Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, next week will be the second anniversary of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting in Parkland. Fred Gutenberg's daughter was among the 17 people killed by the gunman, and he was the guest of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this week at the State of the Union. Now, there were the usual applause lines during the president's State of the Union address Tuesday night, but this one led to Gutenberg getting kicked out of the speech.
So long as I am president, I will always protect your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms.
Gutenberg shouted from the speaker's box after that. He was quickly removed from the audience by a plainclothes police officer.
Yeah, now after the State of the Union speech wrapped up, Gutenberg tweeted out an apology saying he disrupted the speech because he, quote, should not have to listen to the lies about the Second Amendment as happened tonight. That was the quote from him. There has been little movement on any gun legislation over the past several years in Congress, but the Parkland tragedy has led to some changes here in Florida, including banning sales to anyone under the age of 21 years old.
That's right, and there are additional gun measures making their way through the state legislature right now. Some expand gun rights, others would provide for new regulations. So we're beginning the hour with a closer look at this on the Florida Roundup. How are state lawmakers addressing gun reform issues? We want to know what you think, too. Give us a call here on the show at 305-995-1800 and send your tweets to @FloridaRoundup. As we welcome Antonio Finns, political editor with the Palm Beach Post, and Gary Finat of Politico. Hey, guys, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yep, thank you very much.
Antonio, let's start with you. Fred Gutenberg has become one of the most prominent parents associated with the tragedy at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. How does his outburst at the State of the Union affect public opinion, do you think, if at all, when it comes to this issue of gun reform?
Well, right now, it's hard to tell. I mean, the fact of the matter is we've had in Florida since the that terrible Parkland shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, you've had all kinds of different proposals that have come up. Some have been approved back in 2018. Others have stalled since. And the outburst itself, I feel for him. What parent would not? So I don't know that anybody's going to look at that and say, oh, wow, that's a real discredit to the gun safety movement. Absolutely not. But I think the question is, the more serious issue is, for example, in the state Senate, where Bill Gavano, right now the Senate president, is trying to expand background checks to flea market sales of guns and also to gun shows, that the loophole, the infamous loophole that we've been hearing about. And he is taking incredible flack from conservative Republicans. Now, Bill Gavano himself is a conservative Republican. He gets 100% rating from Americans for Prosperity and from the Conservative Union. And yet he is getting pilloried over this. I think that's really the more significant turnout, not so much as outburst, by Fred Gutenberg at the State of the Union on Tuesday night.
All right. And Gary Finat, let's bring you into the conversation. As Antonio said, there is legislation moving in Tallahassee, but very different approaches when you look at the Florida House versus the Florida Senate. Can you break it all down for us? What are our lawmakers looking at?
Well, I think Antonio kind of hit the nail with the hammer. what we've got going on is that there are a couple of bills that are moving over in the House, and they are kind of the ones that would sort of expand rights, gun rights, not huge demonstrable expansions. I mean, like open carry, which has been something that's been debated several times over the last several years. And then we have the approach in the Senate where they've got the bill, which that's more than just a gun show loophole bill. That's a kind of omnibus bill that was sort of taken up in the wake of mass shootings and the questions as to whether or not more needed to be done. And while the gun show loophole has got a lot of focus, it's actually got other elements to that bill. The thing about it is that right now it would appear that legislation is dead on arrival and it has no chance of passing. House Speaker Oliva has said he's opposed to it. And even Governor DeSantis, who came to Bill Galvano's defense against people like even Matt Gaetz and Donald Trump Jr., who had attacked Bill Galvano, Governor DeSantis says he doesn't want the bill. So I just don't know how much you're going to be able to move something in a Senate chamber when you know that it would be a tough vote, and yet, and also there's no prospect of it ever becoming a law. So it just would seem that I would imagine momentum is going to halt on that. And then we have the other two bills, that we have two other bills that are moving through the process that are gun rights bills. I would expect them to get through the House, but like one of them having to do with guns and churches doesn't have a Senate companion, so I don't know how far it's going to go either.
It's 305-995-1800 to join us here on the Florida Roundup. Antonio, we are approaching the second anniversary of the tragedy in Parkland. That was such a momentous event for Florida that it did prompt some changes to the state's gun laws. But 2 years on, you know, a whole slate of activists have come out of that tragedy, including student activists. But as we heard Gary talking about, the politics of this in Florida, to say the least, are pretty complicated, right?
Well, they are. And I think you look at what happened, for example, with this whole question of a constitutional amendment on the ballot to ban assault weapons. And I had a really interesting conversation with Brian Mass, who's a Republican congressman from here, from South Florida, back in late summer. And we were talking about assault weapons. And Brian Mass is one of those people that has come out in favor of banning assault weapons. To our listeners who may not be that familiar with him, you know, he is a military war veteran who lost both legs in an explosion while serving in the military in the Middle East. And what Brian said was, look, what the congressman said is, look, when I joined the military, I was given this weapon. It's a lethal weapon to defend defend myself and to kill the enemy. It's a weapon that is not appropriate for streets of American streets. Very, you know, very plain spoken. It gets, you know, I think most people would agree with that. But you look at the battle that we have had in this state just to get that an assault weapons ban, you know, approved. And the fact that this constitutional amendment has fallen short of the needed number of signatures, I think speaks to where this movement that got so much attention from these really heroic kids at Parkland, at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, when they came out and they led this movement in much of 2018, it's just not been there. I mean, and I don't know why. You know, one of the issues is that younger voters who would be more, you would think would be more engaged with this issue, generally don't go out to vote. We did see an increase in voter registrations among younger voters in 2018. That did happen. But, you know, generally they're not single issue voters. They care about other issues as well. And I think that's part of the reason, you know, 2 years later, you know, the movement that was so inspiring, and which remains very inspiring, hasn't really translated into more legislation and more public policy since that initial success in early 2018, right after the massacre.
That's right. Gary Finot, you see activists like Fred Gutenberg, who's become a national figure in this movement, getting a lot of attention, trying to pressure the Florida legislature and Congress. But in Florida, certainly groups like the NRA and others who are supporting some of the legislation you've been telling us about, they continue to have a lot of influence in Tallahassee, as you've spoken about on this show before, right?
Yes, without a doubt. I mean, let's not forget the current governor basically point blank said that he did not agree with the law that was passed in the aftermath of Parkland and was signed by Governor Rick Scott. So Governor DeSantis is not on board with some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years. We have an attorney general, Ashley Moody, who basically, she had her problems with the law. Now she is defending the law and continues to defend the law in court, because the NRA, as you know, filed a federal lawsuit trying to challenge part of the restrictions that were included in the Parkland bill. But the politics are such that, there was a moment, and it was a moment that came quickly on the heels of the incident in which the legislature did choose to act. Now, the bill that President Galvano has pushed through came in the aftermath of another set of incidents, mass shootings. So you know, it seems to be there has to be some sort of impetus for our things to change. And the fact of the matter is that you've got a lot of Republican lawmakers. And I mean, it's sort of like this balancing act because, you know, there was actually a bill filed by a panhandle Republican to repeal most of the elements of the Parkland law. Now, that bill has also gone nowhere. So you just sort of get the feeling that there is this sort of like, okay, well, we did that a couple of years ago, and that's about the most we're going to do, and we're not going to move forward anymore. And I did want to touch briefly about the assault weapons ban constitutional amendment. I think it's important to also know that part of the reason that they probably didn't make the ballot is because they didn't have the financial resources that you have with some other groups, which have been able to raise large amounts of money, some of it where we have no idea where it's from. And the legislature keeps making it harder to get constitutional amendments on the ballot. So unless you have a large amount of money, it's very difficult to get an amendment on the ballot.
Speaking with Gary Fineout with Politico in Tallahassee, Antonio Fins, the political editor at the Palm Beach Post, here on the Florida Roundup and discussing gun legislation here underway in the Florida House and the Florida Senate as the legislative session continues to move forward. 305-995-1800 is our statewide phone number, 305-995-1800, at Florida Roundup. Couple of tweets here. Josh sending us a note on Twitter. It only takes one crazed individual with a concealed carry permit to make everyone unsafe in public spaces, Josh writes. Kokomo Kid, the America gun culture in Florida and nationwide is sick. I know three people who were shot to death in domestic quarrels using handguns kept for, quote, personal protection. Mitchell is on line one. Go ahead, Mitchell. You're on the radio now.
The one thing that people have not paid attention to is ammunition control. You could ban all imports from East Bloc weapons, and that would put the AK-47s out of business. Another way would be to put a identifier number on every box of shells and require it to be registered in a computer bank every time anybody would buy some shells. And you could have a microchip necessary inside every shell casing so that whenever a shell casing is found on the ground, it could be traced back to the box and to the buyer of the shells. The thing to do is to emphasize that because this stuff is explosive, guns by themselves are no more dangerous than a steel pipe. But when you get real control of the ammunition, you've got control of the loonies.
Mitchell, appreciate that forwarding the conversation. Gary Fineout, I know there had been some effort in some corners to go after ammunition, especially for those high-powered rifles and the semi-automatic and automatic rifles. But, you know, Mitchell has a couple of different ideas there, but each of them going after regulating or being able to track ammunition once it's purchased.
Well, right, and actually there was a bill filed last year, Jamie's Law, which is named after Jamie Gutenberg, and that bill, which would have required background checks on the sales of ammunition, has not gone anywhere. It has not been heard in committee on either side, and so I would dare say that it's probably has a very cloudy outlook as well in terms of going forward. I mean, once again, as I said, it just seems that right now there is not a lot of appetite among the leaders to deal with this. And again, now what's going to be interesting, like I said, is if some of these lesser bills, I'm not saying they're not important, but they are not of as, you know, big importance in terms of the gun control date. I'm going to be intrigued to see whether or not they make it all the way through and whether or not there's going to be a debate on the House floor on this, because you will get into the wider issues.
Right.
People will probably bring up, look, why are we doing this when there's all these other things we're not doing?
Yeah, among those House bills that expand kind of gun rights, would allow guns in churches, even if churches are renting or leasing space inside of a public school. There's also a committee bill in the House that would allow county commissioners, school board members, and elected city officials to be armed at their public meetings. Those are a couple of the types of bills that are making their way through the Florida House. St. Augustine up next. John on line five. Go ahead, John. You're on the radio now.
Hello. I'm a moderate. I'm an independent. I believe that you need reasonable restrictions on gun ownership, background checks, closed D, loophole, and the like. But when you talk about limiting assault weapons and ammunition, you're now addressing the real reason for the Second Amendment, which is not protection, it's not hunting, it's not target practice. It's to ensure freedom against the overreach, potential overreach, of a overly strong central government. I'll take my answer off the air.
John, appreciate that perspective from St. Augustine. Antonio, how about that kind of balance between, as John describes it, reasonable restrictions versus outright bans?
Look, that is a debate. However, what we're seeing is that whether it's the NRA or public officials who really deeply believe what they say is the letter of the law in the Second Amendment, that any incursion on the ability to own weapons or to operate a weapon is an infringement on constitutional rights. And when you start with that kind of argument, it does not leave much space to address some of these other issues, the fine print about background checks, even red flag laws. I mean, we haven't mentioned those, but
right.
I think if you look at this state in the last year or so, and there have been a number of potential tragedies that probably were avoided because of red flag laws. And there's an effort right now to expand it, red flag laws, so that family members themselves can legally request a relative's guns be taken away because of concerns about their behavior or their outlook. These are all, I think, worthy discussions. But when you start from the standpoint that the framers gave us the Second Amendment to defend against overreach by government, and any infringement on that is unconstitutional and a violation of the Constitution, it just does not leave a lot of space to debate these fine print issues.
The red flag laws, we should explain here, Gary, quickly, these were put into place. This was a response from the Florida legislature after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting. It was part of that that act that allows family members or law enforcement to preemptively take away firearms from somebody who a judge deems to be a danger.
Law enforcement. It's important to note law enforcement.
Law enforcement take away those guns from somebody who's deemed to be a danger to him or herself or others. And a number of sheriffs have used that and other law enforcement folks as well. And there's a bit in the Senate bill, in the Galvano bill, that could expand that, no?
I'd have to look.
I think it expands it to emergency EMTs and emergency folks that can also make that kind of a statement. So we're talking about guns here in Florida with Antonio Finns, the political editor with the Palm Beach Post, Gary Fineout with Politico. We're going to take more of your phone calls, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Next week is the two-year anniversary of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school shooting tragedy that changed certainly the gun debate in Florida, as Florida legislators did pass new restrictions for gun ownership for the first time in more than 20 years after that tragedy. Your phone calls and tweets at Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. All coming up after this from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800 at Florida Roundup on Twitter, talking about guns and gun legislation in Florida with the political editor of the Palm Beach Post, Antonio Finns, and Gary Fineout, reporter for Politico. Let's go to Plantation in Broward County. Nancy on Line 8. Go ahead, Nancy. You're on the radio now.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and we have been collecting Ban Assault Weapon Now petitions. And I just wanted to talk about what the speaker had said about how voter registration numbers among young voters are up, but that didn't reflect in the petition signatures. And that is directly because of the methods in which someone can register to vote versus going out to sign a petition. You can register to vote online, in the privacy of your own home, at any point. The petitions, you have to seek out someone in public. And for those of us that have been collecting the petitions, we get at most 30 seconds to catch someone's attention, not enough time to discuss nuance or debate about the merits of the petition. We just have to catch them. And if they say yes right away, we get a signature. And if not, we've lost them. So it's not an apples to oranges comparison. It's not an apples to apples comparison.
So are you, Nancy, are you advocating online petitions somehow have could have legal weight in Florida, ought to have legal weight in Florida in terms of putting these kinds of referenda to voters?
I mean, I can't say that. I just wanted to say that you can't say there is not an interest in an assault weapons ban because voter registration numbers are up and the petition did not get signed.
Got you. Mm-hmm. Understand. Nancy, thanks for sharing that perspective with us here. 305-995-1800.
Here are just a couple of tweets coming into Florida Roundup from listeners. Jonah tweets the show, the purpose of any gun control is to disarm the public for domination. Here's another tweet, though, that BS about the Second Amendment being to prevent government overreach is not supported by the wording of the Second Amendment. America did not have a standing army. The Second Amendment was to provide for militias to fill the gap. Okay, the age-old debate over this. Antonio Finns, you know, we just heard from Moms Demand Action. Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America is an advocacy group that's had real effectiveness in states around the country, in particular in pushing red flag laws, which we touched on earlier, and other measures that increased background checks, which have strong bipartisan support. How do you see groups like Moms Demand over time affecting this debate in Florida and across the country?
Well, you know, I think the model to follow would be, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which back in the early 80s had just embarked on this campaign to address drunk driving by younger drivers, and look, you know, they were able to get the laws changed, raising the drinking age to 21. I think that those organizations have a major role in sort of the public policy debate, and ultimately they're the ones that are going to be the drivers of this. The point that I was making earlier that I think she was speaking to is that, yeah, I think you saw an increase in voter registrations. I wasn't making the argument that there just seems to be a disconnect between younger voters in this issue. My question, and I think Gary addressed some of this in his remarks, but I think the issue is that what it comes down to is, you know, the NRA crowd, the pro-gun crowd, tends to be single issue, meaning that's what drives them to the polls. That's the overriding concern. And on the gun safety side, many gun safety advocates or voters are not generally single issue. There are other issues that they're also concerned about. And perhaps that's why you don't see the kind of the political fervor yet. Now, groups like hers may ultimately change that. I was just making the argument that that the gun rights crowd, the voter that supports gun rights, tends to be a lot more, I don't want to say zealous about it, but certainly a lot more just more intense about it than many of other voters who, you know, the Parkland kids and their followers notwithstanding, other voters who say, yeah, you know, guns are very important for me, but so is Social Security, so is health care, so is, you know, national defense. That was my point.
Right, sure. And Gary, find out, it's why, as you said, despite the fact that Democrats, Republicans, and independents overwhelmingly support measures like increased background checks for weapons purchases, we're not seeing any real action on that in the legislative session. Because as Antonio said, gun rights supporters are more vocal, they're more powerful at the Capitol, and have that intensity that he mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, plus, I hate to put the election year politics into it, but that also, at least at this year, that always plays into it. I mean, we're overall just, you know, 10 seconds. You've got a couple of bills. They're meant to you know, help pump up the base, the Republican base. They're going to do those. But on a lot of other issues, it's most of what's being done this session is very special interest driven, dealing with food fights and different industries and stuff like that. So that plays into it as well. I did want to just get back to that the Senate bill. We talked about it right before the break. I was a little bit confused by the question, and just want to let you know what the bill does in terms of first responders is it puts an obligation on them to tell law enforcement if they're aware of a threat. If they're treating someone and they communicate with them that they know information. So it's not quite that they can themselves ask for risk protection orders, but the information that they could provide to law enforcement could be used for a risk protection order.
Thanks for that clarification, Gary. Much appreciated. Tampa, William, you are up next on line six. Go ahead, William. You're on the radio.
Thank you, everybody, for taking my call. I'm a prior military firearms instructor, and I've always listened to this, debate over gun control, and I have honestly trained over 2,000 people, and I believe that we should have gun control, and that we should have folks going out and getting training and showing, even with, the fact that we had to, defend our Bill of Rights. And I think those that are legit gun owners would want to have that, because to me, if we have somebody that's going out and, not handling a firearm correctly or doing certain things like going out and harming other people, it makes the people that actually enjoy shooting for sport or owning a weapon for personal defense that have gone through the training. And I wonder if we put it to gun owners that way and said, hey, could you be open to developing something to where you're going out and you're getting training and you're getting these things in place? That very quickly makes the people that maybe shouldn't have one or have reasons for not having one kind of rise to the top. And so I guess that's just kind of my viewpoint is I think we're kind of going about the argument. We're either telling people they can't, and there's some horrific things that have occurred. And I'm, again, former law enforcement in the military with that, so I agree. But I think taking that away from people without opening up that real dialogue with gun owners, they're not all bad. They enjoy what they do. And going, hey, what's the best way together to go forward on this? So,
William, I hear you, and thanks for adding to this conversation here about reasonable restrictions versus elimination or bans. Gary, are those kind of, I'll put this title on it, a moderate gun owner? I mean, William in Tampa talking about responsible gun ownership. Are those voices heard? Is there space for those voices in the legislative debate, especially given how bifurcated this issue is amongst the Republican Party between the two chambers in this session?
I think there are attempts. I think that's part of what Senate President Galvano was trying to do, was trying to, thread that needle. It's just that.
But he's stabbing himself with it.
Yeah. What happened, of course, is that all of a sudden focus became on the fact that Mike Bloomberg's not Mike Bloomberg himself, but a group that was created by Mike Bloomberg had given money to Galvano and his efforts to keep the Senate Republican 2 years ago. And suddenly it flared back to life and it went gangbusters on social media and everybody going after him on it. And so it was sort of like, well, that's what's going to happen theoretically, is that you're going to get pilloried by people of your own party if you step out of line. Although, like I said earlier, Governor DeSantis did step forward and said, while he didn't support the bill, he did support Galvano, and he shouldn't be viewed as some sort of acolyte of Mike Bloomberg. But, the politics are tricky, and I think, the Parkland galvanized action, and they stepped forward and did it right after that. But I just like I said, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of interest, especially among a lot of Republicans, to deal with this issue any further at this point in time.
And when a Republican does speak out and support some restrictions, as you just said, they do face quite a bit of blowback.
Yes, absolutely. And like I said, I haven't gotten a full, sort of roundup on what the Senate is going to do and whether or not. The bill that Senate President Galvano has backed has cleared one committee. It has other stops in the Senate. We're about halfway through the session. So you're sitting there and you start doing the math, you start doing the calculus, and you're just like, is this a priority enough of importance to him that he's going to use his clout, such as it is, because it kind of wanes as you get towards the end of your last session as the leader. Is he going to use it to do that? Is he going to try to strike a deal? Because that's probably the only way you're going to get it passed, is he's going to have to trade something with the House and say, this is really important to me. I want this. What can I give you in order to do that?
Could it be guns in churches or guns by county commissioners and school board members, which is what the House legislation is pushing for?
Right, but to be perfectly blunt, I would have to think that that's – no, it would have to be something – it may not even have to do anything to do with guns.
Right, it could be something entirely different.
That's the unusual way that the legislature works, is that things that get traded may have nothing to do with one another.
The unusual way it works. Yeah, we've observed that for many years, haven't we? It's always fascinating to follow the process. And I have to say, Gary and Antonio both, I really appreciate both of you providing these insights in such a calm way about this contentious issue. We continue to get a lot of very intense tweets, it's such a deeply felt issue for voters out there. So it's always good to have your insights as you break down the process for us. With several weeks yet to go, Tom, in the state legislative session, we'll have to see what comes out of it.
Yeah, lanes are narrowing for these issues to get through. Gary Fineout, thanks as always for sharing your reporting with us here on the Florida Rondo. Much appreciated.
Oh, it's great to be on. Thank you.
Antonio Fins, the political editor for the Palm Beach Post. We're going to ask you, Antonio, to stick around because we still want to talk about kind of the new stakes of the Florida primary. Early voting begins in just 4 weeks from today for Florida Democrats. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Well, Iowa grabbed the election spotlight this week as their first in the nation caucus fell apart with no clear winner announced for days. Meanwhile, there remain big questions about election security here in Florida. Two counties here had their election systems hacked by Russia in 2016, but the FBI still won't say publicly which ones.
Now, last month, the feds changed their policy when they find an intrusion. Now they will notify state election officials in addition to county officials if election systems are hacked. Florida Republican Representative Mike Waltz thinks there still needs to be more transparency, though. We spoke with him earlier this week. Congressman Waltz, thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Is this change in FBI policy enough?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's still not enough. The FBI is reliant on local and county election officials to report any irregularities or any wrongdoing. So meaning one of their employees clicks on a phishing email or there's some type of cyber hygiene problem or suspected hacking. The FBI is relying on voluntary reporting. The FBI's concern is if they start making these things public, then they will tamp down on that reporting.
Hey, thanks for joining us today.
We've got embarrassed. The FBI is thinking of who the victim is here in the wrong way. The victim is the public.
Thanks.
And the public deserves to know. We in Congress need to know, and the public needs to know. They need to have the confidence. The public needs to have the confidence that their vote counted how they intended it to be.
Should the public know in real time, in other words, the moment a breach, be it either a spear phishing breach or any other kind of breach to voter rolls or even voter tabulation, should they be notified, the public notified right away?
Yes, however, with one caveat. Mm-hmm. We always have to be cognizant of if the FBI finds out or DHS or the intelligence community. Yeah, you know, they have to protect their sources. We don't want to compromise our intelligence assets and how we found that out.
All this has come about because two counties in Florida, we have since learned, were attacked by Russian hackers in 2016. You received that briefing by the Department of Justice and FBI last May.
Let me just make one important clarification there. All of the counties, there's over 9,000 counties in the United States. And nearly all of them, if not all, were tested by hackers. So they were only able to breach two, but nearly, I call it kind of testing the front door to see if it's locked or not. So this was widespread, and I think we need to send a very clear signal for the Russians to knock it off. The only way that we found out was it was a footnote in the Mueller report that two Florida counties were breached. Had the Mueller report not happened, I don't know that we still to this day would know, and I find that incredibly disturbing.
You were told in that FBI briefing that almost all county election systems in the United States were tested in 2016?
That's right. In all 50 states that the Russians tried in one way or another across, every state in the union. That's right.
Including all 67 counties here in Florida, two of which were breached. Do you know which two?
I do know which two. To this day, the Bureau has not declassified those two, and you know, I'm still honoring that classification. Although I disagree with it, mm-hmm. I'm still honoring it while it's in place.
You served in the armed forces. You served in the mm-hmm. Defense Department. You served in national security. How real
That's right.
is the threat, in your estimation, as the FBI sees it?
The administration has elevated our election infrastructure to what it calls critical infrastructure. So on the same level as ports or electrical grid, other types of cyber infrastructure. So I think important steps have been made on the infrastructure side. I think we have to make the distinction that then there is the influence side that you see on social media, kind of the propaganda side, where you see, for example, the Russians backing a white supremacist rally and then also a Black Lives Matter rally, because all they care about, and this is important for listeners to understand, they don't care about Republican or Democrat. They just care about America being in discord and kind of being at each other's throats. And you know, the more that we're focused inward, we're not focused on what Putin and the Kremlin's doing abroad.
Yeah, and the kind of misinformation well beyond election
and
security
piece,
and election supervisors.
That misinformation piece, I still don't think as a society we've really gotten our arms around.
Representative Waltz, let me ask you personally, mm-hmm. as a voter, not as a U.S. congressman, but as a voter, are you going to change how you vote in terms of the method of you casting your ballot in 2020 because of what you know?
I typically vote by mail, but, you know,
creates
in,
a paper
in the
trail,
early
then.
Voting, it creates a paper trail. We have made big strides in protecting our election infrastructure, and we saw that from 16 to 18. I think we'll see it again in 2020. I'm much less confident on the misinformation piece.
Speaking with Florida Republican Representative Mike Waltz. Now, still to come, how problems in the Iowa caucus raise the stakes for Florida's primary. That's ahead on the Florida Roundup with your phone calls, 305-995-1800. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, for the first time ever, people here in Florida took part in the Iowa caucus this week. Pretty wild, Tom.
Yeah, Hawkeyes coming to the Sunshine State. Certainly, I know something personal about that growing
yeah.
up in Iowa. But this was a first time, huh? Remote caucus goers in several locations throughout the state of Florida did their part in helping pick the winner, but back in Iowa. Now, obviously here, we have since learned that Iowa had a little more than its share of trouble in actually figuring out who won.
In other words, it was a total disaster, right? We've only just learned that it was a photo finish in Iowa between Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg. Took them days to figure out who won. Now, reporter Bradley George of WUSF checked out the satellite caucus situation here in Florida over at the St. Petersburg location, and he joins us now. Hey, Bradley.
Hi, Melissa.
Good to have you. So we saw satellite voting for the Iowa caucus actually all around the world, but it was remarkable to see a really big turnout here in Florida. What did you observe when you checked it out?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it seems like every hour we're learning some new wrinkle in the Iowa caucuses and what a debacle it's turned into. But here, what I saw in St. Pete, it actually went fairly smoothly, all things considered. I mean, you have to keep in mind that most of the people who were caucusing at this event and at the other sites in Port Charlotte and in Gulf Breeze on the Panhandle, most of them are retirees, snowbirds. They've been around the block a little bit. They've had some experience caucusing before. I actually spoke with Eloise Monk. She and her husband spend winters in the Orlando area, and they're committed caucus goers, but because they spend their winters in Florida, it's not something that they've been able to do for a while.
We have wintered away from Iowa for like 15 years, so I haven't been to one for that long. Before that, we were regular. So because they have the satellites this year, why, we're back at it again.
So you had people like the Monks, and you also had folks. I talked to a gentleman who is from Des Moines, and he happened to be on vacation in Florida and learned about this opportunity to caucus. So he took advantage of it while he was here.
Sure, why not? Now, Amy Klobuchar won the satellite caucus in St. Pete. Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden trailed behind her. Certainly lots of Midwesterners in that part of Florida that may have played a role. But I want to ask you, how did the caucus goers here in Florida react when the night went on and there was no clear winner? Were they using this much maligned app that the Iowa Democratic Party was relying on to get results?
Well, this caucus wrapped up at about 7:30, so I don't think anybody in the room really had any kind of sense of what was happening back in Iowa just yet, with in terms of problems with the caucuses themselves or problems reporting the results to the state party through the app. But as you mentioned, or as we talked about, this was you know, a little bit of an older crowd at this caucus, and it was interesting once the actual caucus started, when people started moving into different corners of the room. There was only about 100 people, a little over 100 people. Almost everybody gravitated over to the Klobuchar side of the room. So it was pretty clear that she was going to be the top vote getter or the most viable candidate in this caucus. You contrast that with the fact that there was a very large, very jubilant group of Bernie Sanders supporters from Pinellas County who had come out to this caucus site at this Lutheran church and were there for hours before the caucus started. So you had this large contingent of local Bernie Sanders supporters, but he didn't hit viability in this caucus at all. Actually, when we got to the second alignment or the sort of the second round of people choosing their favorite candidate, most of the Bernie Sanders supporters broke for Elizabeth Warren.
We're talking about Iowa snowbirds in Florida participating in the caucus this week and really how the caucus trouble in Iowa in terms of getting a clear winner could raise the stakes in Florida. 305-995-1800 is our statewide phone number. Maybe you participated as an Iowa snowbird in those caucuses, but you're looking at them as a Florida primary voter. 305-995-1800. Antonio Fens, let me bring you back in, the Palm Beach Post political editor. How does this meltdown in Iowa play in Florida in terms of what's at stake for the Florida primary with early voting in 4 weeks from today?
It has a major impact, largely because you know, conventional wisdom is whoever wins Iowa comes out as the front runner, has the momentum, has the attention. In this case, you had Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders being, if you look at the last results, they're just, you know, it's almost a tie for first, with Buttigieg just ahead of Sanders. But both of those candidates, Buttigieg and Sanders, have shown a remarkable ability to raise money. If they had come out and had the spotlight on them on Monday night, you know, as the declared winner, you know, their ability to have raised a lot of money out of this and propel themselves forward and, you know, would have been exponentially increased. What happened was they didn't get that Iowa bounce. They didn't get that spotlight. And now they go to New Hampshire, you know, next week. And what this does is, that's number one. Number two, I should say, is that Joe Biden's very poor result now raises questions about his electability. And I'm not one to count out Joe Biden yet. He, you know, his firewall is South Carolina. He's been running very strong in a lot of these southern states. But the fact that Biden did very poorly, that he's trailing in some of the polls in New Hampshire, that neither Buttigieg or Sanders was really able to capture that front runner spotlight coming out of Iowa, means that Florida, which is going to vote on March 17th, right after Super Tuesday, kind of is in play. I mean, there is going to be a lot of attention here. And in fact, you know, Mike Bloomberg has opened up offices in St. Pete, Orlando. He's just opened one up in West Palm Beach. I think he's seeing that, hey, I have a shot here.
Watch Bloomberg and for sure. I mean, he is already blanketing radio airwaves around Florida with ads very early on, spending up to close to $1 billion of his own money. He's really betting heavily on Florida. That is one to watch, guys, isn't it?
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that if you look at all the polls, Biden has led in Florida every one of them by wide margins. If he falters, if he doesn't, you know, if he does not succeed in South Carolina, Florida is wide open.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Antonio Fens, political editor at the Palm Beach Post, and Bradley George with WUSF along with us talking about the kind of the aftermath of the Iowa caucus here in Florida. Antonio, one of the real, I think, repercussions, and you alluded to this, was if there's not kind of a clear push, a lot of wind in the sail with the candidate out of Iowa, it can be a fundraising issue. But it also, from a real process standpoint, right, it requires those candidates who are still in it to spend a lot more money in places other than Florida before a very expensive race for expensive media markets here in Florida in 4 weeks.
Absolutely, and especially the week before Florida is Super Tuesday, which is a major money play. So if you are a, I don't want to say nickel and dime candidate, but if you are a candidate that has really struggled to raise a lot of money going into the primary season, your shot to really grab the attention was Iowa, New Hampshire, which is retail politics. It's going to the coffee shops. It's going to, you know, door to door. Once you get beyond those two states, money becomes a factor. And Florida is one of those money states.
It sure is. Bradley George with WUSF, let's bring you back into the discussion. You've got to get up on TV in all the Florida media markets to be competitive here. That costs a lot of money. And if Iowa, after this year's meltdown, becomes less of a factor the next presidential election, that's really something a lot of states have wanted for a long time, including Florida. They want to have more of an impact in the primaries.
That's true. And, you know, I think, you know, I talked about the Bernie Sanders supporters who showed up at the satellite caucus. I should also mention there were also groups of Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren and Biden supporters there as well. And I think some of that might be just some pent-up frustration from a couple of different angles. First of all, you know, in 2018, we had this blue wave across the U.S. And, you know, we saw some impacts of that here in Florida, but not to the extent maybe that it was expected or that it happened in other states. And at the same time, you also, you know, before the Iowa caucus turned into a debacle, maybe there was this kind of sense as well as that by the time Florida votes, will the Florida primary be as important as Super Tuesday or Iowa or New Hampshire or any of the earlier states. So I have to think that if you're a grassroots Democrat in Florida right now, you've got to really be thinking that you're excited about the fact that now the state is going to potentially be in play for the primaries and that we're going to get attention, media attention, but also face-to-face attention from many of these candidates.
From the candidates. You know, and Antonia, let's remind folks, too, Florida moved its primary earlier on the calendar some years ago so that Florida could have more of a say. Right?
It did. And the really big example of that was 2008 when we leapfrogged a bunch of states. And we were penalized by that at the convention with a reduction of delegates. But if you look at the Republican primary that year, it was between John McCain and Mitt Romney when it came to Florida. And Charlie Crist, a Republican at that time, and the governor endorsed McCain. McCain won Florida, and it catapulted him toward the nomination. So it's been a while. I think that was really the last time that Florida played a decisive role in nominating one of the major party's candidates. And I think we were going looking at the season thinking, we're kind of still at the back end, maybe not this year, but maybe we will.
Maybe we will. We'll have to wait and see. The Florida primary is coming up in just over a month. As Tom said, early voting will be getting underway before you know it. Get out and vote wherever you stand. And thank you, Bradley George of WUSF, with us. Also joining the show, Antonia Fins. He is the politics editor for the Palm Beach Post. Guys, great to have you on the Florida Roundup. Thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you for the invite.
Thank you.
And that is our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, WLRN's Director of Radio Operations, and our Technical Director this hour is Peter Meritz. We get engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon. Have a great weekend.